Welcome to the Smart Green Energy Transition Podcast. This is a Smarter Grid Solutions production and is our contribution to the search for impactful solutions to the climate challenge. This podcast will focus on smart, decentralized energy solutions, a crucial but underreported part of the net zero carbon transition. We've timed this podcast to coincide with COP26, which is happening in the Smarter Grid Solutions hometown of Glasgow. We hope to shine a light on the most promising energy system technologies for communities, power grids, and markets.
I'm Graham Ault, Executive Director at Smarter Grid Solutions, and I'm joined today by co-host Rachel Cornick, Project Manager at Smarter Grid Solutions US. Today we're looking at the role that energy services organisations are playing in the clean energy transition. We're joined by Stephen Stead, Director of Strategy and Digital Services in Distributed Energy at Scottish and Southern Energy, a major energy services and solutions company in the UK. Steve, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Why don't we start with a quick introduction to yourself, the organisation, the role that you have? Tell us a bit about that, please.
So, Director of Strategy and Digital Services, part of SSE Group, which is one of the largest sort of integrated energy providers in the UK. Our part of the business, but as a tangent for the core business, historically has been around large central generation, providing power to energy supply businesses, which it also owns. The market is changing. It's changing obviously considerably with the advent of renewables, not necessarily held centrally, a lot of it out at the end of the network, which provides a lot of opportunities, a lot of challenges. The opportunities are having your own renewables, keeping own generation for use locally, which reduces costs, reduces carbon. The challenges are this stuff also works at the end of the cables. It is at thin strips of copper. And if it's not managed properly, it can burn that copper and it can cause issues to the grid. So there's a lot of opportunities for us around deploying these assets. There's a lot of issues with us with deploying these assets around the overall management of it. The other side of what we do in the business, it's not simply the renewables we're deploying. It's not simply the control of those renewables. It's also other elements that will help decarbonize. So within our portfolio, we're looking at deploying private electrical networks where the underlying grid networks can't support the growth in demand or generation. We're looking at decarbonising buildings through energy management systems, deployment of local assets and so forth. We're looking at decarbonising heat with heat networks, primary transition to heat pumps, which again causes issues for the local grid. And we're looking at decarbonising transport. For example, we've done something like 90% of the London bus depots and conversion to EV. Now we're looking at other fleets across the UK and a range of solutions up to sort of forecourt style. So all of that is in the bag that I'm responsible for from a strategy point of view. And from a digital point of view, then there are systems to manage those assets, to make them smart, to balance the energy, to protect the network. And all of that is in my remit as well.
What you've described there, I suppose it's everything in that whole smart, new, flexible, clean energy world. So there's a stack of activity there and a stack of growth. And I'm sure we'll hear through the podcast today, you know, exactly what sorts of things you're doing.
Can I ask for you to explain more about what the private electrical networks means?
In the UK, we've got distributed network operators that have a regulated asset base. However, you will find certain areas where historically, for example, there were networks built out of area that there was competition to opened up in certain areas, and that's going to extend, but primarily under private installation. So it might be a large industrial complex, it might be a business park, it might be a university campus. There's electrical network there that supports a number of buildings, and it could have renewables connected and so forth, that can be developed privately. So that was where it started out. And now we are looking at sort of wider scale. We've got a project called PIRI working with Peterborough, for example, which is about how to decarbonize an entire city. Part of the learning of that is, well, if the local distribution network is constrained or not going to build out fast enough, well, why should that hamper the decarbonisation of a city? So what can we do to support that? So we're looking at heat network on the back of an energy from waste plant. Why are we trenching for the heat network? An old Heineken, I think, was advert, why don't we throw an electrical network in the same trench? So you reduce the civils costs, you get the less disruption to the local community, and you get a electrical network out to similar connection points as your heat network. So we're looking at that. With that, you can then start putting heat storage, electrical storage. You can play one off against the other, and you can manage constraints in the underlying electrical network if you manage your network in conjunction with an underlying DNO network.
How would you describe the stage of development we're at for that now? It sounds very sensible. It sounds really integrated and holistic. You know, where are we in developing those sorts of solutions, do you think?
Yeah, we're currently just about a year and a half into a two-year design program for that particular opportunity. COVID has not helped because a lot of the engineers we needed to get to site and so forth have been delayed. But, you know, within the next 6 months, we'd hope to finish the design and start turning to delivery.
And more widely than that, you know, across the country or elsewhere, you know, are we in the first 1% of these opportunities or early stage, or is...
I mean, it's going to be interesting to see how things move. So there were other larger opportunities that sort of slowed down again with COVID. Bristol City Leap was an £800 million project under Bristol. Not a huge city, but £800 million even so for decarbonisation. And they saw the need for electrical networks, heat networks, EV charging, smart control, all of the components I've discussed. And this was city driven, so they could drive the overall decarbonisation. Other local authorities were toying with the idea and still toy with the idea. It is going to come. You know, you see they're being put under pressure from central government to help drive deployment of heat networks, for example, deployment of EV charging. So although perhaps not regulated to deliver, there is a lot of onus on them to be the focal point for this delivery. So local energy planning, all of these elements. And that culminates in an integrated energy system being deployed or at least led by the local authority. So it will come without a doubt.
How much would you say the drivers are based on sustainability and green energy and climate change versus financial benefits and revenue stacks of the many different projects that you're speaking of?
It's a tipping point, I'll be honest with you. We got, for example, a smart lighting solution that dims streetlights, which is pretty much the majority of a local authority's energy consumption. When we first started out many moons ago, when you had sodium lighting, there were yellow lighting, massive energy consumption, we're working on resistance, so, you know, because that lot of heat burns a lot of energy. So by dimming it, there was a massive energy saving. We went through a period where demand was dropping because as LEDs were rolled out, well, dimming an LED light doesn't save a lot of power. We're now seeing an upsurge in demand because it's actually tipped from cost reduction, i.e. cut the power, save cash, to, well, we don't care if it's only cutting a small bit of cost of energy compared to the price of the system. It is cutting carbon, and we've got to do everything we can to cut carbon. That's just a good yardstick to show there is an absolute tipping point. We're right in the middle now. The other side that you sort of need to keep in the back of your mind, it isn't simply about the local authority itself. It is selling a town, city, or region. To achieve that, it's got to encourage people to move in. Those CSR drivers for those businesses are looking things like green credentials, green buildings, green supply, local renewables. All of those things tick a box. The interesting next stage of the transition you're going to see, and it's also a bit of an argument about price versus carbon. A number of local authorities and other businesses use something called a corporate PPA. So they went out and said, that solar farm is mine. Look at me, I'm great, I'm decarbonising. And a lot of that would have given them a good energy deal if it met with their profile. The issue you are now finding is there is a driver to get absolute green credentials. So get rid of things like greenwashing where you buy a green tariff. So saying that's my solar farm was step one of that. But let's take a local authority. So its main energy consumption is street lighting. When are the street lights on at night? So why a number of them pointing to a solar farm and saying, look at me, I'm green, when it produces energy during the day? So therefore, you now come down to half-hourly proof of origin, which is a far more complex piece. And that's sort of something we're looking to develop. So there you would build local solar farms that will cover daytime. We would twin it with an offshore wind turbine that handles dips in the solar and nighttime. We would put local battery storage and we'll put a control system in to align demand profiles of buildings to the renewable supply. You know, to make that really what you would need a collection, sort of be a renewable collective, for want of a better word, of local businesses all working together under one arrangement to help align demand and renewable generation.
Clearly, with COP26 around the corner, a lot of interest in, you know, who's leading what, who's doing what, who's saying what, and where do the motivations and the aspirations for clean and climate solutions come from. So I wanted to ask you, what's your personal motivation for clean energy and climate solutions? Where does that come from?
It sort of goes back quite a way, actually. I did the first, working with you guys, in fact, first big low-carbon project was Low Carbon London in 2010. prior to that, I was looking at smart grids and energy flexibility for a couple of years, but I'd been in energy for 30 plus years. What led me to it was I didn't like the big boring stuff. You just sort of turn it on and it's there and there's not a lot of complexity to it. And people that run the old coal power plants may disagree with me in that statement. But, you know, it's a single asset and you get people that understand a single asset and they work on it all their lives. It didn't really challenge me. I like the idea of connecting, joining the dots, creating something that works better. You've got greater value by joining the parts, which lent to energy systems. So I was interested in that sort of stuff before decarbonisation. I've always liked new and innovation. So it just so happened in the early days, the new innovation happened to be in decarbonisation. So it was like, you know, a moth to a light. It was the new shiny thing that I liked. And then, my kids start to grow older and you start to see what's happening to the planet. And you think, actually, this isn't about me anymore. It's about my kids, about my family. It's about the next generation. You're seeing a sort of a groundswell now, I think, across the board of people taking a similar view. So, you know, the questions about the tipping point between cash and carbon, it's happening across the board, both in commercial, corporates and in homes. And it's driven by consideration of the future. It's not just about the planet. It's about the next generation.
And moving on to Scottish Southern Energy, the organisation, the company is a main COP26 sponsor. You know, it's got a decades, if not century, long heritage in, you know, clean energy and hydropower in Scotland. How does the company express its mission? You know, how does the whole company come at this?
It's absolutely huge. It's now dealt in the business from top to bottom. So we've got things like a climate academy, where pretty much the majority of the company are signed up to these lectures on what climate change means, what's the science behind it, what can you do for it. You know, there's a whole series of programs about it, but it really sort of struck home to me when I was developing something about how to control flexibility of gas assets and gas peakers, because at the end of the day, you need these assets to balance renewables in the transition period. For us, it was a gas asset. We didn't want to be associated with deploying something that utilized gas. You know, they were willing to forfeit a sort of large revenue opportunity on the basis it no longer aligned to what we are and what we're about. You know, you see the leading moves they're making with creating a massive CCGT plant, purely hydrogen-based, to help provide that intermittency and flexibility. Isn't going to make the same sort of cash in the early days. It's probably going to cost more to get up and running, but that's the sort of commitment, because these solutions are needed to help drive the country down to zero carbon. We're spending £1 billion deploying batteries and solar at massive scale across the UK. Again, not on the local energy systems I was talking about earlier. This is key infrastructure to support UK decarbonisation. Probably about 2 years ago, when we were talking about batteries and our strategy, it was raising eyebrows. And, you know, talking about solar was a definite no-no. Why would you? The returns are too low. But now they're deemed as key building blocks to UK and Ireland decarbonisation. It's stuff we must be involved in, because that is what our business is about. It is about decarbonisation.
You mentioned there, you know, so gas peakers off the table, but, you know, things like solar and storage on the table. What other sorts of solutions or capabilities, you know, is your bit of the business, you know, distributed energy being putting forward?
Energy systems is probably the key focus within it. But I mean, if you go through each bit in turn, so we talked about the private networks. It's the networks plus the assets on them and the alignment between heat and power, clearly to sort of arbitrage between the two and smooth between the two. EV charging solutions, we talked about buses, but we're now looking at fleets. So it's sort of a build it and they will come model. You know, 2 years ago, the idea of building anything without having a captive customer, we wouldn't have touched. We're now, I think we've got a target of about 100 EV hubs across London and 100 plus forecourt style across the UK. And a number of these would be what we call rev hubs, renewable EV hubs. So there's a great big solar farm, private wire through to batteries to forecourt style chargers. So you can guarantee your charge is renewable power. What else? You know, we need to start moving further on. Hydrogen Group has got a big hydrogen play, as I mentioned, but at a distributed level, it will come. Technologies are emerging that will get rid of the cost issue with green hydrogen versus blue hydrogen. And obviously, blue hydrogen works at an industrial decarbonisation scale because of the costs associated with SMR and the carbon capture. When you come down to a more local level, there are a lot of challenges about it, but that is based on sort of current economics around electrolyzers based on cells are very safe because of their mixture of hydrogen and oxygen. They've got membranes in, A lot of the cost is about that safe mix with a membrane between the two gases to stop the thing going bang. If you totally re-engineered that cell and it became a pumped solution, so you pump electrolyte backwards and forwards, create hydrogen, create oxygen, you don't need a membrane. It's simply about pumping. So the engineering involved, the cost is reduced significantly. There are two solutions in that space I'm currently tracking, that if they come off, they again, the reactions are different, not exothermic to the same extent. So, you know, you go through 70-odd% efficiency, if you're lucky, to the low 90s, and a radical reduction in costs. All of a sudden, green hydrogen, even at the local level, is viable. So, you know, we've got to track these technologies. They may or may not work. There may be something fundamental that's missing. But if we're not watching it and we're not tracking it and we're not supporting it through investment in projects such as Period, I mentioned earlier, we're not going to be able to exploit it to help decarbonise.
And where do digital solutions come into that then? We mentioned a few aspects of that earlier, but presumably to make all of those work well together and do something cleverer and smarter.
There's a stack of it. You start at the most basic level, data collection, data aggregation, getting data from smart meters. The next level on that, well, okay, you've got data from a smart meter. You need to understand what that says. So we've got products that do energy analytics around meter data. You take it up to the next level. We've got building energy management systems we deploy, and a smart building platform, so that we'll take the meter data, the building energy management data, put some machine learning on it, and start to optimize the building's energy profile. You then start to connect assets into that and control those assets. So then you've got the control piece, which is another system called Enhance, which is a virtual power plant at one level. As you know, underpinning that is a smart grid platform. So that gives us the ability, for example, to exploit flexibility in load and generation and commercialize that on markets, or maximize local reuse of local generation, manage local constraints to bring more renewables and all sorts of things from that. The same sort of approach, if you then sort of widen it out, we've moved the smart city, smart building platform is also linked into a more holistic smart city platform. So you take that same scheme, the same flexibility, the same control, and you apply it at city level. So buildings are now aggregated components in a citywide scheme. So they are flexible components. Granted, there's a local control system that manages that flexibility, but at a higher level, it is an energy unit that will consume or produce and can be controlled as such. You will have standalone solar, standalone batteries, standalone heat pumps that form part of heat networks, all of which are combined into a wider energy system, which in turn can be managed with a similar control system and optimised to provide higher level flexibility, optimization, reuse of local generation, decarbonisation, and so on. So it's a sort of component-driven stack system that, working from the lowest levels, we can build up to the highest levels to drive decarbonisation from building level right the way up to city and local authority level.
How are you involved in COP26, and what are your expectations and hopes coming out of the conference?
As a business, obviously we're one of the primary sponsors, so hugely engaged. We've been looking at a number of initiatives around the site and across Glasgow to help demonstrate what we're delivering. We've got an interactive smart city demonstration at site to show the sorts of assets that can be connected, how they'll be connected, the benefits they drive, and so forth. So we're looking at it as education and awareness for those that are there, but also the very fact that it's so prominent in the news. Well, so, you know, we talked earlier on about people suddenly waking up to the climate change and the need to do something. This is the sort of thing that focuses the mind. It will hit the news across the UK, given the sorts of leaders that are coming to this country. And that's exactly the sort of optics we need to make people sit up and take note. So for us, it is an educational point, and it is a promotion point for the need for decarbonisation.
And presumably, so some of that promotional will be business to business, and you're looking to
absolutely
talk with, you know, city leaders, world leaders, absolutely, other energy companies, energy users, but then to the public and the wider populace bit of that. You know, some of that exhibition material is in the green zone, then that's open to anybody, so folk can come along and see.
Yeah, we got things in there for people to see. Absolutely, they can see it, they can interact with it, yeah.
Okay, I think we should move on to our little quickfire questions section. Is big wind or small local solar going to be the dominant clean energy solution, do you think?
Both. You can't have one without the other. Big wind, offshore wind, very low cost base now, given the scale that can be deployed. it's got to be there as a bit of a mainstay for the wider solution set. But you look at the profile, you look at the recent issues we've had over here with the drop-off of wind, it isn't the only solution by any stretch. Solar is not quite commercially attractive as it was. It's improving, but it's got to be part of the mix, without a doubt. It must be part of the mix alongside batteries and others, demand control, to help sort of manage and align the profiles of generation and demand, obviously.
Hydrogen or electric for your next car?
Well, the current one's hybrid. The next one would be fully electric. However, hydrogen, whether it ever reaches commercial value on individual cars is the question, but without doubt, there is a role to play. HGV, machinery at construction sites, ports, airports. You know, there's a lot of specialist areas where it will have a role to play. For cars, I get the point about range anxiety and how it addresses that, but you look at the power density increases in batteries as we move forward. And I think, to be honest, by the time it gets to the point that it can be deployed at a domestic level, the battery technology would move so far that it would make a big barrier for hydrogen to sort of enter that market.
Okay, next one. More insulation, a battery, a heat pump, or an EV charger for your next home improvement project?
Probably solar and batteries to demonstrate I'm capturing my own renewables and using it locally.
Next one, we wondered if you had a view on whether it'd be necessary to have very strong government mandates or the open market is going to come up with a lot of the solutions we need for the climate challenge.
I think, again, you need a bit of both. There's a bit of carrot and there's a bit of stick. So there's a number of organisations that, or their image, will be on the front foot. But similarly, there's an awful lot of other reasons, primary sort of costs, resistance to change or whatever it may be, or it's simply not a priority for them, won't move. You've got to have a bit of a government intervention to drive it, but obviously it's not going to be the only thing that sits behind it. CSR power is driving an awful lot of change for an awful lot of businesses these days.
More hard infrastructure or a smarter, more flexible energy system?
Both. We don't have enough of the hard infrastructure, but you wouldn't build it for building its sake. So if you take the reinforcement of the network, consider the winter heat, for example. I think something like four times the electrical heat. We make an awful lot of noise in the UK that we're 80-odd% decarbonised on electricity and got some totally green days, sort of immaterial when you consider you need four times that power to decarbonise heat, which means networks that can manage four times capacity, well, that's not going to be put in the ground overnight, if at all. So you've got to manage some smart control plus some focus reinforcement. It's got to be a mixture of both.
Excellent. And that brings us on very nicely to the very self-centred question from us at Smart Grid Solutions. So it's just knowing what you know about us, and we work together in some of the projects that you've described earlier. What one thing would you say to us, you know, to make sure that we are doing all that we can to promote or support or accelerate this clean energy transition?
Innovate, I think. So you guys, when you first started out, when I first met you, you were one of the few, if not the only company, actually, when we came down to it, that could deliver what we wanted to do for low carbon London in terms of flexible control. Some of it you had in tow already, some of that you openly knew you needed to develop, but you were willing to move and innovate rather than say, you know, this is my product, this is what it does. And the way your business has developed, you've continued to innovate both in terms of markets and solutions. So, you know, we don't have the final solution to zero carbon today. Will we ever have the optimal solution for zero carbon? I don't know, but if we don't innovate, we're never going to get there.
Excellent. Thank you. We share that view. We're partway into a journey. Your company's a leader. I think we are leading in the niche or the subsector that we are operating in, but we think there's a long way to go and a lot to do. I'm sure that'll be a view that's shared around the place as well. I wanted to say a big thank you, Steve. It's been a fascinating conversation. We've dipped into quite a few topics. I'm sure there's a lot more we could say and discuss on all of them. Thank you very much for sharing your insights and your views on climate agenda and your company's activities with us.
No problem at all. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Smart Green Energy Transition podcast, exploring the challenges and innovations in the net zero carbon transition. Our guest was Steve Stead, Director of Strategy and Digital Services in Distributed Energy at Scottish and Southern Energy. The presenters were Graham Ault and Rachel Cornick. The producer was Natasha Barbieri. Until next time, thanks for listening.